you're visiting with Royce Bridge, and it is Monday, the 5th of June, 2006.
Well, when I came to Houston, previous to that, I had been in Dallas. Anyhow, I had been coming back and forth for years to Houston because of my friendship with Jim Love. And
how did that friendship start?
Well, in 1952, he and I both graduated from Baylor, but I did not know him when we were in school because he was a business major. And after he graduated, he wanted to come back and work in the theater. And I was involved with a woman who was teaching in the theater, had gotten her BFA and MFA in theater arts from Baylor. And she and Jim lived in the same old house there. He had an apartment upstairs, she had an apartment downstairs. So in 1952, when I was visiting her, she said, this guy moved in and he gave me a little background of Jim's history. He said, you'd probably like to meet him. So I met him and suddenly became friends. So then I'd stay with Jim when I would come to visit her. And so he was involved with the theater also at that point, Paul Baker and Baylor Theater, which later became the Dallas Theater Center. Was quite a big thing going all through the late 50s, from 1952 until just a few years ago. It still exists, but not with any of these people that I knew at that time. But anyhow, I had done work in the theater, and so that's how Jim and I got to be friends. And so he would come up to Dallas to visit me where I had my film studio. I would come down to Waco, and then I would see all the shows they did. And then when it became the Dallas Theater Center, he would come up there. So there's a lot of back and forthism in all the 50s.
Uh-huh.
And then he came to Houston in about 54, and I would come down, and he started showing at New Arts Gallery in 57, and I would come and see some of his shows. So there was a lot of back and forthism. And so when I came in 66, he had the front part of this little building that he rented at 908 Truxillo. And so he let me rent two rooms from him. And so that's when I decided to leave the beach and come back into civilization again. Be a little more gregarious than I had been being a so-called amateur hermit off on the beach. I decided that would be a good location to work from. So that gets me up to being here in Houston at that time.
Well, before you tell me about your work and how what you were doing in that studio with your work, what was Houston like then? How did it feel to you coming back from your beach time?
Well, of course, I hadn't been that isolated on the beach, but I still, even while I was there, I would go back and forth either to Dallas, because I still had friends in Dallas, or to Houston. So I really wasn't out of an urban situation. But by 1966, the Dallas Museum of Contemporary Art and Douglas McKagey no longer existed. So the exciting things were happening were here in Houston at the Contemporary Museum that Jerry McKagey was the director. And Jim, of course, was worked for her installing and so forth. So in those latter part of the 50s, coming to Houston, as I say, I really was not that far removed from the urban. It was not any kind of a cultural shock
right.
at all.
Right.
But what was exciting was the fact of all the stuff that was going on in Houston, art-wise, and the fact that galleries like the New Arts was showing contemporary Texas people. So that all of that added together to make it interesting to me to then come to Houston once I decided to not be a hermit on the beach.
Well, and did you said you started showing your work at New Galleries?
Well, not at New Arts. No, I did not show there.
New Arts?
No. That was Catherine Swenson in the New Arts Gallery. But as soon as I got here in 66, Diane David, who had David Gallery, which at that time was on San Felipe, and she had seen some of my things and invited me to have a show. So I put together a show that I had there in 1966. I don't remember now, but it was, I think it was about September or November.
You had really just arrived that year.
Yeah.
And so the work you showed had been works that you'd made earlier.
Some of that had been earlier works, right, that I had recovered from people I had left them with.
And that's the photograph that you showed me?
That photograph, that was the installation of that show of mine in 1966. And most of the pieces in there, they all had, not all, most of them had movement of some kind. And so I called them wooden machines, for lack of a better terminology. And but it included some of these others. There were found objects that were moving. The main piece was called the Singer, which is based on an old Singer sewing machine that I built a top on. And by pedaling the pedal, it made things move. And also you could play the keyboard and things. The flags would wave. And I had made a film about this back in 1963, which has gotten through the years a lot of notoriety and shown to the Museum of Modern Art several times. And so that particular piece was sort of, you know, but it was, every time you play it, it would begin being flying off of it. I mean, so it was sort of destined to destroy itself to some extent.
But, did it survive?
Well, it survived only, you know, sort of a tall totem piece that I called Memorial to the Singer. Then two or three of them were included in a show I recently had there with Jim and with David McManaway back in June, a year ago. So from that show in 1966, well, because I had already met the Dave McNeils, so I knew them also. But the fact, you know, I was always interested in what they were doing and what was going on in St. Thomas, because at that point they were
right.
All the things going on. And Jerry had been there until she died. When Dave McNeil did invite me to come over in 1964 to help this French cinematographer, Pierre Mendel, and he did. I suppose you'd call it a fantastic documentary. I never see the finished thing of a show he had put together there in St. Thomas called Surrealism. So he used a lot of their surrealist pieces they had. And this photographer, cinematographer, was putting it in some kind of a movie with a fantasy sort of theme. I never did see the finished product. But she wanted me to come over and help be his gopher more than anything else as far as helping with that film. So that was something else prior to me being here in Houston that was related to Neil's and the art scene.
Well, now, when you came in 1966, how long were you here before you left?
Well, I was here until 1969. I was here until August of 1969. And besides making sculpture during that period of time, and I had two shows at the gallery during that time, and also in 1967, 68, for two semesters, I was invited by John O'Neill, who was the head of the Rice Art Department at that time, to be what they called a guest lecturer. Every Friday, I would come over there, and all day Friday, I'd work with both Bob Gamblin's drawing class and Earl Staley's drawing class, and we'd all do motion picture film. So I was sort of there helping them get a little film book.
How fun!
Yeah, it was great fun. And also at that time, the Media Center was sort of starting up, and they had several visiting people that came in and did lectures that were Gerald O'Grady was the head of the dad at that point. He invited these various people that were pretty well known in the, in those days they called it independent filmmaking and stuff like that. And it was basically short experimental art films, which they all talked about, which I made a number of those things. Just,
where are those films?
Well, I have, Betty has some, we finally got them put on video where they were compressed to fit the video, so they didn't have to be the letterbox style, which, you know, compresses this way.
Right.
These fit on, fit the format, and they were taken from the original film, so there's got 10 of them. It was, one is one that I did of Paul Soldenberg when he did a Hackney in Dallas. And I took his images and rearranged them into my own, and storyline, if you will, which he didn't have a storyline, you know, and put my own soundtrack to it. And I sent him a print, and he thought he liked it. I was surprised he liked it. And his distributor, Castelli, bought several prints of that film and distributed. And rented to colleges and places like that for years. So that's on there. So there's a film I made about David McManaway. It's called Joe Mo. So they're, you know, they're about anywhere from, some of them are short as 3 minutes, and some of them are, the Oldenburg film was about 9.5 minutes long.
When did you make the first
1949, while I was still at Baylor in the theater, they were trying to get into 16mm production. And so I was interested in that, and I worked with them, and I learned everything I learned about making film, and I invented my own style of animation. So I started this film studio in Dallas in 1951. And I did animated television commercials on film. I did for 10 years. And so I had, you know, I had all that. Well, 16mm, 16mm after World War II became a big thing. And it was,
right.
You know, it was, but there were not very many animation studios in those days. And so I thought, well, I'll just start one.
So were you doing the illustrating yourself in the animation studio? Where are those early now?
Well, I have some prints of them, prints of some of them. And so most of the film itself, it's gotten so fragile, but it also has gotten some kind of a virus or something that attacks the acetate of the film. So it has lots of splotches and all that kind of, you know, dirty looking stuff on it, you know. And unfortunately, I did not, if I'd had the originals to go back to, I could have gotten these nice, beautiful copies on video that I have of these 10 or so so-called experimental films. They look wonderful, but they're in color. And so the color and the sound are good. The commercials don't look so good, but they're made from black and white prints. And so the sound suffers, and they say all this sort of splotchy, dirty looking stuff. But I mean, they're still kind of amusing.
Well, now, when you came to this and had a studio with Jim, were you doing any filming?
Well, not doing any film except what I did at Rice.
Right.
As a guest lecturer.
Right.
So I did make a film while I was over there just to show students, this is the way we do animation. I mean, this is one form
right. Of
animation.
Well, what did Houston be? Do you remember Houston as 60s, late 60s? And then you left and then you came back in the 70s?
No, I went, well, after we started this Rice film project, a man that I knew who was the head of the University of Oklahoma Art Department heard about it, and he came down to sort of see what we were doing. And so then he invited me to come to the University of Oklahoma and start a BFA and an MFA program in film, in art. And so I did. I went up there for 4 years and did that. So it was kind of an interesting little sideline. But I worked on sculpture too at that time. But during those 5 years, let's see, I did more with film than I did with sculpture. And of course, the teaching, I never had taught, you know, before. And I thought, well, that would be an interesting experience. I probably learned a lot.
Enjoy.
I did. Oh, yeah. Yeah. 4 years, that was plenty. I mean, that was all. I mean, then I came back to the beach in Port Aransas. I had a studio there that I built. And then I kept the studio over here through the 70s. Once again, starting with Jim Lowell first in the front part of that same building.
So
he
had stayed there the whole time.
Stayed there the whole time. So by 74, I was back around Houston then. And then later on, when he moved to Blossom Street, I had his studio there.
Right.
For a while, I rented some space kind of down, got a block down the street, and I had a studio there from 1980 to about 1983. But and then also having Port Aransas, too, so I could sort of run back and forth between urban and the
not
very far away from urban.
Well, when you're thinking this from 1966 to about 69 or 70, how does Houston seem to you from an art standpoint?
Well, I liked what was going on in Houston then. I had liked what was happening in Dallas, but when Douglas McGahee left,
right,
then it fell apart for me there. Whereas Houston, even though by that time Jerry McGahee was dead, nonetheless, Mrs. Dave McNeil and the ongoing aspect of art in Houston was far more exciting to me, you know, than any other place that I knew of in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to get back into that milieu of sort of art that appealed to me, and the energy that was going on in Houston during those years. In the 60s, I'm through the 60s and the 70s both.
How would you compare that energy to Houston today?
Well, I'm just not that familiar. You know, I haven't kept up with, do not know many of the young artists today. They seem to be, you know, quite energetic. The thing that is different for them than it was for us, because when Jim Love and I started making art, there were very, very few people who even called themselves artists, or then there were very few galleries that were showing art. But by the time I was teaching at the University of Oklahoma, especially in the graduate school, why, everybody wanted to be a superstar or some kind in the art world. So, you know, there were plenty of people, and then, of course, they all felt like they should have some. There was all of a sudden artists began to multiply, and they were just sort of everywhere, and it was a lot harder for them because of the competition. There was competition then, where
right.
Jim and I started, nobody even wanted to do that, you know. And so.
Well, it was a very conservative time in the country coming out of World War II.
Especially, yeah. Dallas more so, and Dallas sort of still is, kind of.
Yeah.
Although it's a little bit, you know, different now. I haven't been there that much in recent years, so I couldn't talk about Dallas because I don't know it anymore. But Houston has always been more of an exciting art place to me. But maybe just because of the past things I remember about Houston, because I know most of the people who are, you know, that are still involved in art and the people, but the younger people, the young artists, I don't know very many of them. I see them here at cities or at other shows and things,
right.
But I'm not really that familiar with them and their, you know, their view of it from their standpoint.
How did you and Betty start?
I started, my first show was in 1980, but I knew her from 1977, and as soon as she started her own gallery, why she invited me to come with her, and I, at that time, I still was supposed to have a show, although I never did, with Diane David, because she was kind of winding it down, but Ann Robinson had a gallery, so I did have two shows with Ann Robinson, and then after that, then I came with Betty. So I knew her when she started her gallery, but it was about another 3 years before I actually had a show with her.
How did you start making constructions?
Well, it happened. Unbeknownst to me, it seems logical now. At the time, it did not make, you know, but anyhow, I did a lot of set design when I was in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
And I did the first version of Waiting for Godot, which was done in 1956 in Dallas, and I was working with the director. And of the Dallas Little Theater, it was called then. And he got the rights to do Waiting for the Dough right shortly after it ran out in New York. And this was after the Miami show, which didn't go over well. The one in New York was kind of a hit. It got to be popular. Anyway, I did the set for that. And as part of the lobby exhibit, I put in some of my little models that I had made working up to the set design. And this man named Caden Calhoun, who had a gallery there in Dallas, came up to me and he says, you know, your sets look very structural and very sculpture-like. And he says, would you be interested in making some more sculpture-like things like that? And I'll show them. And I said, hey, if they look sculptural, I can make sculpture. I mean, but, you know, but I was not unaware. I mean, even when I was doing the sets, I was not unaware of his part, like Giacometti and his set, not set design, but I mean, these things that to me looked like set design, particularly the palace at 4 a.m. some of those constructions
uh-huh.
that he had made.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I feel like I have stolen a good bit from Mr. Giacometti back in those days. So I was not unaware. I mean, I was not that naive is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
But I did not intend for these sets to necessarily be sculpture. But so from then on, the things I made, I sort of called them little theaters. And they were little theaters. And you know, they were very structural. They looked like proscenium openings, kind of.
Yeah.
And what happened in them, within them was a lot of play going on. So it kind of gave something to fit in with my theater experience that I'd had there later with Paul Baker and my wife-to-be eventually. I married her a number of years later. It went all sort of tied together.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, if they were willing to call it sculpture, I was willing to call it sculpture. I always designate myself a Whitmer. That's the way I sort of referred to myself other than being a wood sculptor or something. I just called myself a Whitmer.
Well, you know, it's interesting, the parallel is a parallel there with Jim as far as the theater background.
Okay. Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Set building background, and okay. also using sound optics and varying media.
But part of that, from my standpoint, was just having done all that animation. I mean, you know,
uh-huh.
it was almost like I could not make it move to some extent because that was, and I always enjoyed the movement, although I certainly did not, I mean, that was not what interested me, but it was just sort of one more aspect. It became play-like or a little theater-like because they're like little puppets.
Now, are you doing ready for sound with
no.
movie work?
No. In fact, I'm being very lazy these days, and Betty Moody is very unhappy that I haven't had a show with her in a long time, and I'm unhappy from one standpoint, but then on the other standpoint, best way I can phrase it is this, I ran away to the beach, as I like to phrase it, not so much to make art, although he only did it for a couple of years, but I wanted to try that as a living experience. And I felt like that whatever I've made, the sculpture and these years, was more a reflection of the life I was living, rather than it was not like that I was doing this as a career or as a avocation or even an occupation. It was more just a description of and reflection of the life that I was living in. And most of it to this day is still a very contemplative life, where I sit and I read a lot, and I think a lot, and I write down things, not for making stories or publishing, but for just for myself. And so that's what continues with me, and I'm not just driven to do the carpentry part anymore that I used to. And a lot of the ones I used to make were involved in, through the 80s particularly, a lot of the boat type shapes, because I was making a lot of boats that I mean, actual sailing around boats and stuff. And so I thought, well, why not make an art boat? And so I made a bunch of those, and for some reason, other people seemed to be willing to call them art boats, and that was fine with me. So it solved several things. I mean, most everything I've done, the things I wanted to do when I was 9 years old as a kid, that I couldn't do because I didn't know how to do the carpentry, and I didn't have the money to buy the materials. So I built tree houses. I've done all of those kind of things, built boats that were you know, things that used to stir my imagination as a child. I still do, but not as much from the carpentry standpoint.
Right. Right.
The excitement of the thought of it all is still so it may seem pure laziness, but it's not completely laziness.
Let me ask you if you can remember your conversations with Jim, but also with others. What would you all sit and talk about, you know, after work or over a beer or whatever in those days? Were you talking about materials or art or the city or life or all of it?
Well, kind of all of it. Mostly, David McManaway and I, when I was in Dallas, every day we'd spend some amount of time either going to what we called our favorite bar or our stand-up bar, you know, where you could stand up at the bar and order a draft beer like in the old days, you know. Mm-hmm. And we'd talk about, but as you say, everything. We'd talk about, you know, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and then maybe we'd talk a little art, and usually from the standpoint of, you know, that we didn't like the very sort of, everybody was doing it too formalized, sort of, even in Dallas, you know, it was very, very formal. And we always thought art is fun. I mean, you should have fun doing that. But they had to make it where you had to put on your tux to go there or something, you know, it got too precious. So we talked about those kind of things. Same with Jim. He and I used to talk about, of course, with Jim, we had more of a theater background and people we knew from the theater mm-hmm. that we not only talked about, we kept up. We went to New York to see some shows that they did, that Paul Baker and IXY and different ones. So there was still a lot of that theater connection. And so we had all that in common. So
right.
We could, you know, not see each other for, you know, 3 or 4 months. And when we sit down, we'd just pick right up where we left off.
Right.
And so some of it was philosophy. Some of it was gossip, you know. Some of it was about, never about materials that much, because Jim and I both had the feeling for the found objects. And I showed him the junk pile in Waco, where he got his whole first show that he had at Catherine Spencer there at New York's in 1957. He got that whole show from that one visit to that wonderful junkyard. So we had junkyards in common, which he also had with other artists, one in Fort Worth named Charlie Williams, who's been dead a long time. So we would, you know, all those sort of things, but they were, it was all, we never took art to be that serious thing we had to put on long faces and make some aesthetic judgments about. We never even looked at it from an art history standpoint, although we knew about art history. We were not that naive, but we did not feel like we were continuing art history. We just sort of were doing our own sort of thing.
Right.
And if people wanted to call that art or put it into any kind of a category, then progression of art. I mean, you know, because art historians like to, you know, they like to see something, this leads to this, and this leads to this, you know. And we never worried about things like that. And we actually, usually we made fun of that sort of an approach, you know, when people would come up and give us, that is so, you know, like something to say. And of course, we could see relationships. I mean, we weren't, we were totally divorced. Divorced from stealing from anybody that we'd like to steal from, you know. Of course, like Mattaway and I both borrowed from old Parnell a lot. And, you know, anybody could accuse us of reading other people's mails to some extent.
Well, but don't you think art artists are constantly...
Okay, the eclecticism, I mean, that's part of it.
Were you here when the CAA was being formed and saw that, or had that happened before you came back, didn't it?
The CAA.
Contemporary Arts Association, that later became the CAM.
No. The first time that I was involved with it, I don't remember when Jerry McGee was first hired, what they called it, Contemporary Arts Association, or if they were calling it at that point, CAM, Contemporary Arts Association.
No, CAA.
Okay, well, yes, I was around.
You knew that when it was
over by the
Provincial Building?
Yeah. In fact, when I not have something else to do, or just for the heck of it, I'd come down here and sometimes help Jim with installations of the show. And he and I went together once to pick up some paintings that Jerry wanted for Forest Fest. And I thought, about Forest Fest.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first time both Jim and I met Forest Fest. It was pretty wild and woolly, and then...
What was he like?
Well, he's a weird gentleman, that's all there is to it. But very, very fascinating, very fascinating. And so his theories and his things he felt he discovered, he took it very seriously. And at first, Jim and I were sort of worried, because we thought maybe he wanted us to be his disciples or something, you know. So, and the various mutilations that he had done very well, where we wondered, now, does he expect us to do that so we can be his friends, you know? And of course, we were kidding about it, but nonetheless, you know. And once you got to his place...
Where was that place?
It was down on, near Matagorda. It was down from Bay City. And it was on a little island, a little peninsula, rather. And you couldn't get there by car. The only way that you could get there is you go down as close as you could, you honk your horn, maybe... was expecting you and waited to see you, he'd come across his boat and get you. But once you were on his side of the water,
you were on his side.
You were on his side and you were stuck until he decided he could let you go. So
how did it work this summer, do you know?
Well, back in 1946, something like that, 45 maybe, somebody suggested he ought to take his, because he was in San Antonio at that time. Take his paintings to and show them to Betty Parsons. Well, he did, but she had several shows with Forrest. So that's really how he rather got started.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And so she even had a, about the same time she was been selling out her gallery and everything, two of the guys at Boss, her inventory, then they've had several big shows of Forrest stuff. And where he used to sell his paintings. And I had Bob Alexander Curtis, her name was, when I worked with her. We went down to Bay City and I helped her gather stuff. I'd already gathered a bunch of stuff about fire, so letters and we photographed some things that were there that nobody had any photographs of. So I went through the years, accumulated a lot of Forest Fest information. We got more working with her through that Smithsonian Archives thing. And so I don't know where I was going with that. You must have asked a question that I thought I had to give that little preface to. Betty Parsons would sell his paintings for $35 and $50 a piece back in 45 and 46, along in there. They started then having shows up there and selling Parsons' best paintings for $30,000 and stuff like that. So, you know, he kind of got to be more of a phenomenon, let's say. And Walter Hopkins, for years, was going to do a Forest Fest show. Well, he never did, but I wish that he had, because he was very interested in Forest Fest paintings and stuff. I wasn't so interested in Forest Fest paintings as I was in the weird personality. And
he died in 70?
77, I think it was.
Uh-huh. Well, what else comes to your mind about your work, and how it changed, or if it did really change, or what are the strains of consistency, or the way it grew over that whole time period?
Well, just here during the Houston period of time, there was not that much. At that point, most everything I was making were still little theaters of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And they were described by either, sometimes it'd be in a box, but sometimes it had just a frame around them. But they still, you know, the moving parts were still little actors in some kind of little play and stuff. So it wasn't really, though, until I left OU teaching there and came back to the beach. Then I got into more of the boats and the, to me, the mythical aspects of boats and things like that. So I concentrated more on, and so the sculpture was no longer, you know, but it started,
yeah.
It started looking like boats, is what it started
right.
looking like. So,
right.
so it, I went through that, and I, while doing that, I also got interested, because I've always been interested in Union psychology, and I had been keeping track of some dreams, and in some of the dreams I began to see some images that reminded me of the shamanic or sorcerer images that are in cave paintings in France and stuff like this. So I did again do some research, so then I began doing more shaman related, and so by that time, I built this treehouse out in the woods. I don't know if you knew Madeline O'Connor, who was an artist.
I'm off Victoria.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, she had some wonderful property out near Victoria. She just let me use, and I built a treehouse, and I built what I call the Shrine Grove, and so I built several pieces of state in the woods until a big flood came along and washed them away. But so then I went into more of the philosophy of not only shamanism, but just philosophical philosophy, which I still am very interested in. I just don't project it into any kind of imagery nowadays. So my various steps were first I did heroes, and then I did hermits, and I did shamans, and then boats. So of course the boats were actually before the shamans, but I mean it sounds better to put it the other way. And so those were kind of the steps that in my progression, if it were a progression, or at least passage through, let's say, the art world. And to this day, of course, I'm still invited to, you know, little slideshows and talks and things like that from time to time. But I haven't made I haven't had any good dreams. That's what it boils down to in a long time. But I want to go to the trouble to do the carpentry. I feel like, you know, having imagined them or something, right, they're kind of complete in themselves, and I don't need to build that, whereas I used to enjoy the actual carpentry too. Now I guess I'm lazy and I don't enjoy the building as much as I used to.
Well, where is this introspection, sort of reflection, dreamlike, intellectual, and spiritual search? Where is it taking you? Where are you right now?
Well,
where have you found out?
Well, I feel like that I am of some value. I have a number of, well, we'll call them lady friends, or like other terminology, that I've known for 40 or 50 years, some just a few years. But for whatever reason, it started when I didn't realize this until I was teaching at the University of Oklahoma, and one of the undergraduates came up to me and said, "You know, you're about the same age as my father. You even kind of look like my father, but you sure don't talk like my father." And so a lot of people are seeking things. They just want somebody to talk to about it. And I don't know if it's because I was a good listener or their concerns were interesting to me. But whatever I do nowadays is more of a philosophical talking to a lot of these people that I've known for the past. They come down and visit me, say, 3 or 4 days. Now, I don't mean I'm any kind of a guru or a mentor or anything like that. I don't give them advice. You know, I learn more from them than they do from me as far as I'm concerned. But it's just about living. And it goes back once again to Thoreau, who said, I mean, you know, he wanted to live, so when it came time to die, you know, he would have said, well, you know, I have lived a life.
Mm-hmm.
And that I have enjoyed that life. So that has always appealed to me. I've sort of been living a life, and luckily I've enjoyed it, and everything has been quite exciting and quite fun. I mean, I keep using that word. It's not the right kind of word, but I don't know of any other word that describes it as well. And so it's the progressive, ongoing, open-ended, as long as, you know, I don't fall in a ditch or something like that.
Let me ask you, when is the last time you made a physical work of art?
Well, I made several small things that I call little shrines. And I started doing this because some people decided that, because I knew all along I was going to be cremated, and so I said, well, hey, you know, wouldn't it be fun if we had some of your ashes, you know, and stuff? And I said, okay. If that's the case, then I made some little bright bridge reliquaries and gave them to selected people. I mean, it had to be somebody, you know, that was amenable to this idea. But then it turns out that, well, like Madeline McConnell was one that had one, and she died. I mean, you know, about three of these people have died, so I haven't done that anymore. But there's about five or six out there floating around somewhere.
That was the most recent.
Yeah, so it would be, you know, somewhere. I probably have not made anything since 2001, probably. I haven't made even any of those. But those are the most recent things. They're more just sort of a personalized gift type of thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all ex-girlfriends of some sort, you know.
You know, there's something kind of blissful about taking a scene by yourself on the beach. It's quiet. I want to talk to you about the boats in a minute.
When I was 9 years old, out on a leachy hill for my parents' trip, there was no water within 50 miles in any direction, but I wanted to build a boat. I always wanted to build a boat, so finally, when I did get 4 inches, well then, not just, but I built about 20 real sailing boats, or reeling boats, or fishing boats, and about 20 park boats.
What happened to the real boat?
What
about this one?
That was, as I say, that's the one from San Antonio.
Okay.
At the San Antonio Art Museum there.
When you were a little boy, did you have this voice inside of you, or did you just start creating things, or did you just jump in there? I mean, you had an awful lot of stuff that came out of you.
Well, mostly I have to say it this way, that the way things happened were just, that just sort of fell into them, in as much as starting with, when I left the University of Texas in 1944, I was going to be an aeronautical engineer because I like to draw pictures of airplanes and make model airplanes.
Makes sense.
I got there and found out, oh, you have to take calculus and physics, and also even I took mechanical drawing and stuff, and I just decided, no, engineering part is not for me. So just by default, I began taking some art courses because, you know, I thought, well, I still like to draw. So I take some of these art courses. And also the other wonderful thing about that, in all of the art department at the University of Texas, there were only two guys, me and another guy, and all these beautiful young ladies. I thought, hey, this is the place to be. So then I went in the Navy. And I was just being a clerk typist because I had had typing. And they wanted to start a Navy newspaper in this particular area where I was. And so the admiral looked through the service jackets, and just because I had 2 years of English, they said, well, let's see if he, well, I had also some experience in the past with running my grandfather's mimeograph machine. So I knew how to do mimeograph. So they had me start this Navy newspaper. And then a larger Navy newspaper said, hey, we want to incorporate all of this together. So it was a civilian. There were a lot of civilians in the area. This was in Seattle, Washington, I'm speaking of.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had me come over and mail my own paper with them. Of course, they had a regular lithograph. So then I began to learn photography and stuff that I've used ever since. But had I not just fallen into those things.
Now, were you in the military with us?
I was in the Navy. Service. I was 2 years in the Navy. And so the whole time I was there, I learned things that I've used ever since and enjoyed everything. I thought, well, I know how to do newspaper stuff. And so there might be a way I could make a living. So when I came back, I went to Baylor to mostly just get a journalism degree. And also because of the things that were going on in the theater, I had heard about that. A friend of mine who was going to Baylor, and I thought, well, that'll be interesting too, because I was in all my high school plays, and I liked all the acting and that sort of thing. And so then when I got to Baylor, though, just by happenstance, one of the men that was teaching sort of a journalism advertising class had an advertising agency downtown. And he had assigned us something our very first day, and I drew a little picture to go along with it, a little cartoon. And after his class, he said, would I be interested in coming and working in his agency? So, hey, I was making $1 an hour, and that was money. I mean, and also I was being a commercial artist. I learned all about the things you have to do, preparing for it to be reproduced and that sort of thing. So these things just sort of,
they grew.
And once again, as I said earlier about getting into the sculpture, it's because this guy said, hey, your sets look sculptural. Well, I didn't necessarily so fancy the question. No, I never had much of a vision of me being an artist or being anything necessarily. Well, all these things came along and they were fun, and they just sort of all added one onto the other until they became a fascinating for me life that I've lived up to now.
Yeah.
So it's just luck. I consider myself a very lucky person. Some people might call it fate, some people might call it, you know. But the other thing I have said, okay, they maybe handed me the ball, but I didn't drop it, I had to run it. The main thing I would say is that art has been a great excitement to me, but art was never the thing in itself. It was just sort of one more wondrous thing in the life I've been so lucky to have lived.
Well, that almost about says it all.